chapter 8, more about legal language. They have no lawyers among them, for they consider them as a sort of people whose profession it is to disguise matters. That was said by Sir Thomas More. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States several years ago was elucidating in the course of the court's opinion a little point of law. Coming to consider the validity of the tax from this point of view, he wrote, while not questioning at all that in common understanding it was direct merely on income and only indirect on property, it was held that, considering the substance of things, it was direct on property in a constitutional sense, since to burden an income by a tax was, from the point of substance, to burden the property from which the income was derived, and thus accomplish the very thing which the provision as to apportionment of direct taxes was adopted to prevent. Moreover, in addition, the conclusion reached in the Pollock case did not in any degree involve holding that income taxes generically and necessarily came within the class of direct taxes on property, but on the contrary recognized the fact that taxation on income was in its nature an excise entitled to be enforced as such, unless and until it was concluded that to enforce it would amount to accomplishing the result which the requirement as to apportionment of direct taxation was adopted to prevent, in which case the duty would arise to disregard form and consider substance alone, and hence subject the tax to the regulation as to apportionment, which otherwise as an excise would not apply to it. From this is substance, it indisputably arises that the contention that the amendment treats the tax on income as a direct tax, although it is relieved from apportionment and is necessarily therefore not subject to the rule of uniformity, as such rule only applies to taxes which are not direct, thus destroying the two great classifications which have been recognized and enforced from the beginning, is wholly without foundation, since the command of the amendment that all income taxes shall not be subject to apportionment by a consideration of the sources from which the taxed income may be derived forbids the application to such taxes of the rule applied in the Pollock case, by which alone such taxes were removed from the great class of excises, duties, and imposts subject to the rule of uniformity and were placed under the other or direct class. Unquote. This could go on for hours. As a matter of fact, it did. And incidentally, the legal point which the learned justice was making so crystal clear had not the slightest bearing on the decision in the case. But it would be far too easy to pile up example after example of the nonsense that is legal language. The quoted tidbit is, of course, an exaggerated instance. But it is exaggerated only in degree and not in kind. Almost all legal sentences, whether they appear in judges' opinions, written statutes, or ordinary bills of sale, have a way of reading as though they had been translated from the German by someone with a rather meager knowledge of English. Invariably, they are long. Invariably, they are awkward. Invariably and inevitably, they make plentiful use of the abstract, fuzzy, clumsy words which are so essential to the solemn hocus-pocus of the law. Now it is generally conceded that the purpose of language, whether written, spoken, or gestured, is to convey ideas from one person to another. The best kind of language, the best use of language, is that which conveys ideas most clearly and most completely. Gertrude Stein and James Joyce notwithstanding. But the language of the law seems almost deliberately designed to confuse and muddle the ideas it purports to convey. That quality of legal language can itself be useful on only one supposition. It can be useful only if the ideas themselves are so confused and muddled and empty that an attempt to express those ideas in clear, precise language would betray their true nature. In that case, muddiness of expression can serve very nicely to conceal muddiness of thought. And no segment of the English language in use today is so muddy, so confusing, so hard to pin down to its supposed meaning as the language of the law. It ranges from the ambiguous to the completely incomprehensible. To the non-lawyer, legal language is, as mentioned before, to all intents and purposes, a foreign tongue. It uses words and phrases which are totally unfamiliar to him, or it uses words and phrases which he can find in his vocabulary, but uses them in such a way that he is immediately aware that they must mean, in the law, something quite different from what they mean to him. Or, on the rare occasions when a whole legal sentence seems to be made up of familiar words taken in their accustomed meaning, the sentence itself is likely to be so constructed that it doesn't make common sense. Oh well, the non-lawyer will say with a shrug, I suppose it means something to a lawyer. That is why people rarely bother to read insurance policies or mortgages or acts of Congress. They know perfectly well that they will never be able to grasp most of the ideas that are allegedly being conveyed. Even if a legally phrased document of one kind or another is of the utmost personal importance to the man who signs it or hears of it, he will seldom make the painful effort of trying to get clear in his head what the funny language in which it is written is supposed to mean. He will just trust his lawyer, or somebody else's lawyer, that it does mean something, that it means something definite, and that there is a good reason for saying it in a way that prevents him from understanding it. Sometimes, moreover, he will later have cause to regret that blind trust. Yet why, if you think it over for a minute, should people not be privileged to understand completely and precisely any written laws that directly concern them, any business documents they have to sign, any code of rules and restrictions which applies to them and under which they perpetually live? Why should not the ideas, vitally important to someone as they always are, which are said to lie behind any glob of legal language, be common property, freely available to anyone interested, instead of being the private and secret possession of the legal fraternity? As pointed out previously, the law, regardless of any intellectual pretensions about it, does not at bottom deal with some esoteric or highly specialized field of activity like the artistic valuation of symphonic music, or higher calculus, or biochemical experimentation. If it did, there would be a reason, an excuse for the use of language unfamiliar and unintelligible to 99 people out of 100. Nor would the 99 have any cause to care. But the fact is that law deals with the ordinary affairs of ordinary human beings carrying on their daily lives. Why then should the law use a language, language being, remember, no more than a means of communicating ideas which those ordinary human beings cannot hope to understand? Certainly a man who enters a business deal of any kind, whether he is buying a radio on the installment plan or setting up a trust fund to take care of his family, would seem entitled to know, to his own complete intellectual satisfaction, just what he is getting out of it and just what he may be getting in for. the legal document he signs won't tell him. Certainly a man whose democratically elected government enacts a law which will regulate him or tax him or do him a favor would seem entitled to know, if he wants to know, exactly how the new statute is going to affect him. His lawyer may advise him, and may be right or wrong, but reading the statute won't tell him. Certainly, a man who loses a lawsuit would seem entitled to know why he lost it. The court's opinion won't tell him. Why? Why doesn't and why shouldn't legal language carry its message of meaning as clearly and fully as does a cookbook or an almanac or a column of classified advertisements to anyone who wants to know what ideas the words are intended to convey? The answer is, of course, that the chief function which legal language performs is not to convey ideas clearly, but rather to so conceal the confusion and vagueness and emptiness of legal thinking that the difficulties which beset any non-lawyer who tries to make sense out of the law seem to stem from the law itself instead of from the ideas, or lack of ideas, behind it. It is the big unfamiliar words and the long looping sentences that turn the trick. Spoken or written with a straight face, as they always are, they give an appearance of deep and serious thought, regardless of the fact that they may be, in essence, utterly meaningless. Moreover, as has been mentioned previously, the lawyers themselves, almost without exception, are just as thoroughly taken in by the ponderous pomposity of legal language as are the laymen. They actually believe and will stoutly maintain those great, big, wonderful ideas to the initiated. If you can't talk Greek, they say in effect to the non-lawyers, then you really can't expect to understand us when we talk Greek. But don't for a second suppose that we don't understand each other perfectly and precisely. The catch is, of course, that the lawyers are not talking Greek, or Russian, or Sanskrit either. They are talking, in a fashion, English. Moreover, they are talking about matters, business matters, government matters, personal matters, which any non-lawyer is quite capable of comprehending. Furthermore, if they were talking Greek, they could presumably translate it accurately and intelligibly into a familiar tongue without spoiling or losing any of the sense. But they can't or won't translate the jargon of the law into plain workaday English. The communication of legal ideas, it appears, cannot be trusted to any conveyance but the lawyer's private patois, which is, unfortunately, all too true. For the law, as you may have heard before, is entirely made up of abstract general principles. None of those principles has any real or necessary relation to the solid substance of human affairs. All of them are so ambiguous, and many of them are so contradictory that it is literally impossible to find a definite and sure solution, regardless of whether it might be a good solution or a bad solution, to the simplest, smallest practical problem anywhere in the mass of principles that compose the law. And the sole reason why that fact is not generally appreciated by either lawyers or non-lawyers is that the principles are phrased in language which is not only bafflingly incomprehensible in its own right, but which is composed of words that have no real or necessary relation to the solid substance of human affairs either. Thus, the whole abracadabra of the law swings around a sort of circular paradox. Legal language in statutes, documents, court opinions, makes use of strange, unfamiliar words because those words tie up to the abstract principles of which the law is composed. Except in reference to those principles, the words, as used, mean even less than nothing. But the principles themselves are utterly unintelligible, except in terms of the legal words in which they are phrased. Neither words nor principles have any direct relation to tangible earthly things. Like Alphonse and Gaston, they can do no more than keep bowing back and forth to each other. No wonder, then, that the lawyers can never translate their lingo into plain English so that it makes any sense at all. Ask what any legal word means, they would have to define it in the light of the principle or principles of law to which it refers. Ask what the principle means, they could scarcely explain it except in terms of the legal words in which it is expressed. For instance, the legal word title doesn't signify anything except insofar as it refers, among others, to the abstract principles that are said to determine to whom title belongs. Whereas the title principle, that title belongs to the mortgagor, or the legal principle that title belongs to the mortgagee, for either may be true, doesn't signify anything either unless you know what title means. Of course, there is one way, and the only one way, to explain something of what a legal principle is supposed to mean in plain English. That is to describe the specific lawsuits in which courts have made specific decisions and have said they were making them on the basis of that principle. But the necessity of such a procedure immediately gives away the fact that the principles are intrinsically meaningless. For how on earth can a principle be the reason for a decision if it can only be defined by listing the decisions it was the reason for? No matter which way you slice it, the result remains the same. Legal language, wherever it happens to be used, is a hodgepodge of outlandish words and phrases, because those words and phrases are what the principles of the law are made of. The principles of the law are made of those outlandish words and phrases because they are not really reasons for decisions, but obscure and thoroughly unconvincing rationalizations of decisions. And if they were written in ordinary English, everybody could see how silly, how irrelevant, and how inconclusive they are. If everybody could see how silly legal principles are, the law would lose its dignity and then its power, and so would the lawyers. So legal language, by obstructing instead of assisting the communication of ideas, is very useful to the lawyers. It enables them to keep on saying nothing with an air of great importance and getting away with it. Yet the lawyers, taken as a whole, cannot by any means be accused of deliberately hoodwinking the public with their devious dialectic and their precious principles and their long, eloquent language. They too are blissfully unaware that the sounds they make are essentially empty of reasoning, of meaning, excuse me. And this is not so strange, for self-deception, especially if it is self-serving, is one of the easiest of arts. Consider the fact that the lawyers, and that includes the judges, have been rigorously trained for years in the hocus-pocus of legal language and legal principles. They have been taught the difficult technique of tossing those abstract words around. They have had drilled into their heads by constant catechism the omniscience and omnipotence of the law. They have seen and read that important people like Supreme Court justices and Wall Street law partners treat the law as seriously and deferentially as they treat the scriptures. They discover, too, that all non-lawyers seem terribly impressed by this language, which sounds so unfamiliar and so important. So why ask questions? Why doubt that the world is flat when someone else takes it as a matter of course? And especially, why doubt it if it is to your own personal advantage to accept and believe it? Why not instead try to become a Supreme Court justice or a Wall Street law partner yourself? Every once in a while, however, a lawyer comes along who has the stubborn skepticism necessary to see through the whole solemn sleight of mind, that is, the law, and who has the temerity to say so. The greatest of these was the late Justice Holmes, especially where constitutional law was concerned. Time and time again, he would demolish a 50-page court opinion, written in sonorous legal sentences that piled abstract principle upon abstract principle, with a few words of dissent spoken in plain English. "The law as you lay it down," he would say in effect, "sounds impressive and impeccable, but of course it really has nothing to do with the facts of the case." And the lawyers, though they had come to regard Holmes as the grand old man of their profession, and though they respected the legal writing he had done in his youth, were always bothered and bewildered when he dismissed a fine-spun skein of legal logic with a snap of his fingers. Strange as it may seem, it is his similar unwillingness to swallow the sacredness of the law that has turned the lawyers in a body viciously against Justice Black today. They do not hate him because he is a New Dealer. So is Justice Reed, whom they respect. They do not hate him because he was a Ku Kluxer. Justice McReynolds' notorious and continuing racial intolerance has brought no squawks from the legal clan. The lawyers hate Black because he, too, without the age or the legal reputation of a Holmes to serve him as armor, has dared to doubt in print that there is universal truth behind accepted legal principles or solid substance behind legal language. Why, they say of him, that Black doesn't even know the law, which only means that he knows the law too well for what it really is. What the lawyers care about in a judge or a fellow lawyer is that he play the legal game with the rest of them, that he talk their talk and respect their rules and not go around kicking pins in their pretty principles, sticking pins in their pretty principles. He can be a New Dealer or a Ku Kluxer or a single taxer or an advocate of free love, just so long as he stays within the familiar framework of legal phraseology and expressing his ideas and prejudices wherever they happen to impinge on the law. A lawyer who argues that sit-down strikes are perfectly legal, basing his argument entirely on legal principles and phrasing it in legal language, and it can, of course, be done, will be accorded far more respect by his brethren than a lawyer who argues that men ought to be made to keep their business promises, but neglects to drag in the law of contracts to prove it. The kind of lawyer who is never lost for legal language, who would never think of countering a legal principle with a practical argument, but only with another legal principle, who would never dream of questioning any of the process of the law, that kind of lawyer is the pride and joy of the profession. He is what almost every lawyer tries hardest to be. He is known as the lawyer's lawyer. Except in a purely professional capacity, in which capacity they can be both useful and expensive, you will do well to keep away from lawyers' lawyers. They are walking, talking exhibits of the lawyer's belief in their own nonsense. They are the epitome of the intellectual inbreeding that infests the whole legal fraternity. And since lawyers' lawyers are the idols of their fellows, it is small wonder that lawyers take their law and their legal talk in dead earnest. It is small wonder that they think a vested interest subject to be divested, or a frankly incorporeal hereditament, is as real and definite and substantial as a brick outhouse. For the sad fact is that almost every lawyer, in his heart and in his own small way, is a lawyer's lawyer. Thus, legal language works as a double protection of the mighty fraud of the law. On the one side, it keeps the non-lawyers from finding out that legal logic is so full of holes that it is practically one vast void. On the other side, the glib use of legal language is so universally accepted by the lawyers as the merit badge of their profession, the hallmark of the lawyer's lawyer, that they never stop to question the ideas that are said to lie behind the words, being kept busy enough and contented enough trying to manipulate the words in imitation of their heroes. The truth is that legal language makes almost as little common sense to the lawyers as it does to the layman. But how can any lawyer afford to admit that fact, even to himself, when his position in the community, his prestige among his fellow craftsmen, and his own sense of self-respect all hang on the assumption that he does know what he is talking about? There is one more argument that a lawyer is likely to make in defense of the confusing and artificial words that make up legal language. And through legal language, legal principles. And through legal principles, the law. Watch out for it. Of course, he will grant the law is built of abstract ideas and concepts and principles. And abstract ideas have to be expressed in special words. And the special words, because they deal with abstract ideas, cannot be as precise of meaning as words that deal with solid things like rocks or restaurants or kitty cars. But what, he will ask, is wrong with that? Men are always thinking and talking in abstractions and using words like love or democracy or confusion or abstraction to convey their ideas. A contingent interest means as much to us lawyers as a friendly interest means to you. You can't define friendly interest very clearly or precisely either. Due process of law is just as definite as dictatorship. Constitutional or unconstitutional isn't any more ambiguous than good or bad. Moreover, he will go on, the whole ideal and purpose of the law is to maintain in human relations and affairs a well-known popular abstraction called justice. Try to define justice any more accurately than you can define any legal concept you can think of. As a matter of fact, the chief intent of the law as a complicated science is to make the idea of justice more precise, to make it more readily and more certainly applicable to any fact situation, any problem, any dispute that may ever arise. And you can't split an abstract ideal into separate parts. You can't reduce it to principles and sub-principles without phrasing them in abstract and therefore somewhat imprecise terms. Hence, legal language. The answer to this defense of the law and its language is contained right in the defendant's own plea. Even leaving aside the obvious fact that the law, time after time, produces results that strike most people as wickedly unfair or unjust, in which case the lawyers invariably say, that's too bad. But that's the law, all right. The answer is still there. The answer is that you can't split an abstract ideal into separate parts. You can't reduce it to principles and sub-principles, period. The whole business of trying to split up justice into parts or principles in order to get a better, sure grasp of it is absurd. Is absurd as cutting up a worm in order to get a better hold of it. In the first place, the original animal is quickly disintegrated in the process. In the second place, each new little piece, each sub-principle becomes a squirming abstraction in its own right. Each is now as hard to grab hold of, as hard to pin down to preciseness, as was the mother abstraction. Thus, you will rarely find the lawyers or the judges either trying to apply the concept of justice to the settlement of a legal problem. Instead, you will find them fighting over a dozen equally abstract concepts, all phrased in legal language, of course, and trying to decide which of those should be applied. And as noted before, the choice of the right concepts or of the controlling principles is a highly haphazard and arbitrary business, no matter how simple the facts of the problem. For facts don't fit into consideration or affection with a public interest any more automatically or certainly than they fit into justice. Moreover, and this is even more important, the concentration of the law on its own pet brood of concepts and principles has meant the sad disintegration of the old-fashioned non-legal idea of justice. Lawyers are always so absorbed in their little game of matching legal abstractions that they have all but forgotten the one abstraction which is the excuse for there being any law at all. They take justice for granted and stick to their contracts and their torts. But you can no more take justice for granted than you can cut it up and stuff it into cubbyholes of legal language. The lawyer who would defend the abstract language of the law is right as rain when he says that people think and talk of human conduct in abstract ways, in terms of right and wrong, fair and unfair. But he is dead wrong as soon as he asserts that the strange-sounding abstractions of the law have any more real or necessary relation to ideals about human conduct than they have to the facts of human conduct. Legal words and concepts and principles float in a purgatory of their own, halfway between the heaven of abstract ideals and the hell of plain facts, and completely out of touch with both of them. That is why in the last analysis, the language of the law is inherently meaningless. It purports, on the one hand, to tie up in a general way with specific fact situations. It purports, on the other hand, to tie up in a general way to the great abstractions, justice. Yet in trying to bridge the gap between the facts and the abstraction so that justice may be scientifically and almost automatically applied to practical problems, the law has only succeeded in developing a liturgy of principles too far removed from the facts to have any meaning in relation to the facts, and too far removed from the abstraction to make any sense in terms of justice. Still, legal language is a great little language to those who live by it and on it. And you don't even have to use words like trover or assumpsit to have a lot of fun out of it. For instance, a bill recently before Congress contained this charming provision. Throughout the act, the present tense includes the past and the future tenses, and the future, the present. The masculine gender includes the feminine and neuter. The singular number includes the plural and the plural the singular. Only to a lawyer might the men are beating him mean, among other things, she is going to beat it. Chapter 9, Incubators of the Law. The legal apprentice, he sweats and he strains to memorize every principle. He'd learn a lot more in the end for his pains by studying something sensible. That's an anonymous quote. As every good fascist knows, the perpetuation of the fascist fraud depends in the long run on the training of fledglings in the faith. The dictators catch their conscripts young and discipline them to think in goose step. Promises of reward for the faithful and ominous warnings about the dangers of nonconformity play their part in making apprentices firmly believe a mass of lies, half-truths, and nonsense. Doubt, even the tiniest wondering doubt, is the cardinal sin. There are few heretics. The law cannot catch its communicants so young. But the same mental goose step and the same kind of hopes and fears are used, perhaps not so purposefully, but just as efficaciously, to instill a fighting belief in the nonsense of the law. And of course, it is on the rigid training of apprentices in the art that the perpetuation of the legal legend depends. There was a time when the law, like other more substantial and more useful trades, was learned in the shop of a full-blown practitioner. An aspiring lawyer studied his precepts and his principles while serving a term as office assistant to some member of the bar. Today, the members of the bar must usually pay for their assistance with something more than a lot of legal language dressed up as words of wisdom. The trade has acquired academic pretensions, and those citadels of logical legerdemain known as law schools are now the incubators of the law. Consequently, the hope of the law, that is, the hope of the lawyers that their game will go on indefinitely, undiminished and undisputed, lies with the law schools. And conversely, the one slim hope that the big balloon of inflated nonsense may ever be exploded by internal combustion lies with the law schools too. Once the professional gibberish jugglers have proceeded beyond the training stage, it is almost always too late. They have to be caught young in the law to be turned into disciples or heretics. In order to teach apprentices how to talk the language and how to reason in the proper abstract circles, the law schools have divided the law's massive principles into big chunks. Each chunk represents a field of law and is taught in a separate course or courses. There are contracts and torts and trusts. There are constitutional law and criminal law and labor law. There are fields and courses by the score. Of course, an actual case may fall into several fields at the same time. It may involve, for instance, the Constitution and a crime and a labor dispute. But that will not faze the law schools. So far as they are concerned, it is the principles, not the cases, that really matter. And so the same case will show up in constitutional law and in criminal law and in labor law. It will not, however, show up in the same way. In constitutional law, the relevant principles of constitutional law will be examined. In criminal law, the relevant principles of criminal law will be examined. In labor law, the relevant principles of labor law will be examined. In each one of the courses, the aspects of the case that fall into the other two course categories will be either glossed over or omitted entirely. A student may thus have to take three courses in order to understand thoroughly, even from the legal standpoint, what one decision is all about, but not in order to learn any one field of law. Thus, law school courses, since they are cut out of the pseudoscience of law, inevitably focus on generalities and abstractions rather than on the solution of specific problems. A student might even study a case in a dozen different courses and thus learn all about the law of the case and still not have the slightest comprehension of or insight into the real down-to-earth factual difficulty or controversy that brought the case into court. Sometimes a field of law is too big to be stuffed into one course. For example, property law is commonly divided into real property and personal property. Neither real nor personal, of course, means what it means in everyday conversation. And wills and mortgages and negotiable instruments and several more. But then property law is for the most part only a big branch of contract law. Moreover, corporation law, a field extensive enough to have various subdivisions of its own, is in essence nothing but a branch of property law. It is almost as hard to keep straight the hierarchy of legal fields and courses as it is to sort out the abstract principles of which the different courses are constructed. And either process is like trying to cut water with a knife. One of the biggest and strangest fields of legal learning is something known as pleading and procedure. The law schools divide pleading and procedure into many courses, and some of these courses, like evidence, are rated as fields unto themselves. But the strange thing about pleading and procedure is not its size. Property law is at least as big and full of principles. The strange thing is that the lawyers in the law schools do not even pretend to themselves that the principles and rules of pleading and procedure have anything to do with the solution of practical problems. Pleading and procedure is admittedly just a lot of verbal complications and technicalities that lawyers have to memorize or know where to look up before they can practice their trade. And that admission is, of course, unique in the law. As a matter of fact, the lawyers and the law schools lump the whole remainder of the law together. Contracts and criminal law and trusts and torts and the rest of the card catalog of abstract principles and call it all substantive law, as opposed to the adjective or procedural law of the pleading and procedure courses. The term substantive law is supposed to imply that the principles of contracts and torts and the rest really cope with the substance of human or social problems. But even the lawyers can't make such a claim for pleading and procedure. Pleading and procedure covers all the principles and rules of law which govern the way lawyers may make use of other principles and rules of law. If that sounds complicated, so is pleading and procedure. For P&P encompasses the code of precepts according to which the legal game is played once a dispute actually starts on its way into court. And when you begin dealing with a lot of abstract principles about the proper manipulation of other abstract principles, you can't help getting somewhat confused. Don't suppose either that the principles and rules of P&P are, for the most part, any more precise or any less ambiguous than other principles of law. A bit of evidence at a trial does not fall into the famous irrelevant, incompetent, and immaterial classification any more automatically than a killing falls into second-degree murder. A legal dispute does not involve two separate causes of action, which only means that it will probably have to be tried in two separate lawsuits, any more readily or scientifically than a piece of paper with writing on it involves an executory contract. The principles of P&P are just as slippery when you try to apply them to the facts of trying a lawsuit as are other legal principles when you try to apply them to the facts that lie behind a lawsuit. Moreover, even though the P&P principles admittedly contribute nothing at all to the actual solution of the problems that the law is called on to solve, the decision in any law case is as likely to be hung on a procedural rule as on a substantive principle. All too often, not only justice, but also the regular principles of substantive law are thrown out the window simply because some lawyer, in handling his client's case, has forgotten or violated a procedural rule. Thus, a killing may be, without so much as a legal doubt, a punishable murder, and still the murderer may go free, for a time or even for good, just because a bit of evidence used in the trial is labeled irrelevant, incompetent, and immaterial. A man with a legal claim so clear and valid that neither a lawyer nor a non-lawyer would question his right to have that claim satisfied may get nothing out of it except a bill for counsel fee, simply because his lawyer, at some stage of the case, has been caught using the wrong words according to the principles of pleading and procedure. Perhaps all this discussion of the P&P field may seem irrelevant, incompetent, and immaterial to the question of how the law schools go about producing consecrated devotees of the law. Yet there is this to remember. The lawyers and the law schools admit that P&P, or practice, as this alliterative field is sometimes called, deals exclusively with the tricks of the trade. The legal neophytes are told that what they learn under the heading of P&P constitutes the technique of the lawyer's art. As a dentist learns how to handle his drill, so a lawyer learns his P&P. By contrast, the rest of the law, the substantive principles of property and quasi-contracts, oh yes, there is that too, and corporations and all, are pounded into the young legal brain as ultimate truths about life. Even after the apprentice graduates from law school, when he comes to take his bar examination, he will find a distinction carefully preserved. One part of his ordeal will test his knowledge of substantive law, and the other part will test his knowledge of pleading and procedure. One represents wisdom, the other represents skill. What the law's apprentices rarely learn and are rarely given half a chance to find out is that the whole of the law is nothing but a technique to be mastered and adroitness to be achieved. That technique, reduced to its simplest terms, is the technique of using a new language. That is all the law student learns in his courses on P&P. That is all the law student learns in his courses in substantive law. But because the former are frankly labeled technique and the latter are labeled truth, the student comes to believe implicitly that there is a gaping difference in kind, where actually there is scarcely so much as a difference in degree. The original burden of proof is on the plaintiff, is a principle of P&P, and may help a lawyer win a lawsuit. If the defendant's action was not the proximate cause of the injury, then the defendant is not legally responsible, is a principle of torts, and may help a lawyer win a lawsuit. All that a student ever learns about either of these principles, or about any other principle of either division of law, is how to say them and when and where it may be useful to say them. The point is that the law schools, by admitting that one segment of legal education deals with the devices of the trade, make quite plausible the fable that the rest of the law represents something much more solid. With the procedural courses frankly set to one side as technique, the big empty words and the vague abstract principles of the other courses assume a more credible aura of depth and reality to the newcomer. He can, and does, then believe that the words have meaning, and that the principles are nuggets of wisdom, and it is essential to the perpetuation of the legal legend that he should believe this, for it would be fatal to the profession, to its self-respect and its solemnity and its power, if any generation of rising lawyers were allowed or encouraged to discover the real truth about the stuff they study, which is that all the legal principles they ever learn amount to no more than tricks of the trade, and that all the courses they ever take are courses in P&P. And so the law schools stick to their principles and to the pretense that the principles stand for eternal verities, which lawyers, after learning how to do it, graciously apply to the hurly-burly of man's earthly affairs. The principles, as a matter of fact, used to be dished at the students without so much as any trimmings around them. That was when law schools were an innovation, scorned by most lawyers as an effort and none too efficient preparation for the practice of law, just as schools of journalism are scorned by most newspapermen today. In those days, and for some time after, law students learned practically nothing about naked principles. The principles of each field of law were sorted out and arranged by sub-principles and counter-principles in a hornbook of torts or trusts or whatever. The students studied their hornbooks, listened to lectures devoted mainly to explaining and reconciling the principles so that they appeared to fit into one neat little ball of abstract knowledge, and religiously memorized the principles. They might never so much as read the record of a single lawsuit. Why should they clutter their minds with disconcerting and trivial facts when they were engaged in learning great and general truths? But late in the last century, a reputed revolution in the manner of teaching law began to take the law schools by storm. The new idea was to feed the students the opinions written by judges in actual cases and let them fish for principles among the judges' words. Obviously, it was not the intention of this new approach to legal education to minimize the importance of principles as such. The purpose was to let the students ponder how the law in action made use of its principles, for judicial opinions amounted to no more than explanations of actual legal decisions in terms of the principles that controlled. The students still had to learn the principles, but they had to find them first. Of course, the students did not have to fish in the dark. In each field of law, a big bunch of opinions was gathered together by some recognized authority in that branch of legal learning and was then arranged according to the principles illustrated by the opinions in a casebook. The students then read the right cases in the right order, and the principles practically popped out at them from the pages. The facts behind any case did not really matter, and were often omitted entirely from the reprint of the judge's opinion, as were the parts of the opinion that dealt with other fields of law. What was important still was to learn the deathless principles, enhanced a bit in impressiveness by the fact that they were now taken right out of the judge's mouths. The casebook method of teaching law is still the vogue in the law schools. Fledgling lawyers are no longer encouraged to take their principles straight. In order to learn that acceptance of an offer is essential to the validity of a contract, they must plow through half a dozen verbose judicial outpourings, which say just that in 1,000 times the space. In order to learn that it is unconstitutional for a state to attempt to tax property outside its jurisdiction, they must worry through 5 or 10 judicial gems like Senior versus Brayton. But when they have finished, they will usually have learned no more than that acceptance of an offer is essential to the validity of a contract, or that it is unconstitutional for a state to attempt to tax property outside its jurisdiction. In many ways, the old-fashioned hornbook method of legal education made more sense. It was more direct and more straightforward, and you could learn more principles faster. Law students today pay tribute to it when, after taking a course from a casebook, they study for their examination in the course from a hornbook. Moreover, it is an interesting commentary on the most advanced law schools, which have carried the casebook method to such extremes that the principles do not always come quite clear to the students, that their graduates invariably have to take special cram courses in the bare principles of law in order to pass their bar examinations and be admitted to the membership in the legal fraternity. As a matter of fact, these advanced law schools, and there are only a handful of them, with their extreme use of the case method of teaching, deserve a special word. Despite the fact that they do not teach their students the law any too well, they do teach something else. In so doing, they are traitors to the legal legend and a potential threat to the perpetuation of the racket of the law. For they actually encourage their students to dig out of the cases a little more than abstract legal principles. The bald human facts that bring any dispute into court are rated as worth consideration, not merely as an excuse for the application of the law, but their own right. These few law schools still divide legal education into courses based on different fields of law, but the courses in the fields are more likely to be cut out according to types of practical problems: government control of business or corporation management, instead of according to tables of abstract principles. More significantly, though, regardless of course names, the courses themselves, or most of them, for even the most advanced law schools, cannot entirely avoid law-consecrated teachers, are taught with a different emphasis. That emphasis is on the non-legal aspects of earthly affairs and problems, which the facts of any lawsuit bring to light. Students are trained not to discard these matters as irrelevant, but rather to concentrate on them, to think about fair and reasonable solutions that might be applied to various kinds of problems, still from the practical standpoint. If, for instance, a milk company goes to law to protest against a state statute setting the price of milk, the past profits or lack of profits of the milk distributors, the medical need of milk for slum children, the present financial shape of dairy farmers, the personnel and liability of the government agency doing the price setting, all may be treated as just as important as the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, the police power of the state in question, or the affectation or non-affectation of the milk industry with a public interest. If a widow sues a railroad company because her husband was killed at a grade crossing, the annual toll of grade crossing fatalities and the cost of eliminating such crossings altogether and the well-known weakness of both judges and juries when confronted with weeping widows may all come into the discussion along with the doctrines of contributory negligence, proximate cause, and a last clear chance. Not that the principles of law are altogether neglected in these advanced law school courses. the students inevitably still read and memorize and try to reconcile the same concepts and abstractions. But the tough meat of factual problems is mixed into their educational diet. The case has become more than settings for the sanctification of legal principles. Now the results of this kind of teaching are strange and varied. In the first place, the fledgling lawyers do not learn the principles nearly so well as their predecessors used to learn them by the hornbook method, nor as their contemporaries learn them by the regular casebook method. The intrusion of factual issues and of other considerations which touch the law only remotely make the principles harder to concentrate on and harder to remember. That is why they have to take cram courses after they graduate from law school in order to pass their bar examinations. The bar examination and the cram courses deal almost exclusively with the law. Moreover, the attempt to tie together the real problems that lie behind all law cases and the abstract principles on which decisions in law cases are said to be based usually results in one of two things. For the less intellectually sturdy students, the result will be utter confusion. They will neither understand the problems nor learn the principles. But for the brighter boys, the result will likely be a realization that the problems and the principles have very little in common. From that realization, it is but a short step to a sort of unformulated contempt for the law and its principles. And if legal neophytes should ever begin to realize en masse that legal principles are largely constructed of long words and irrelevant abstractions, it would be the beginning of the end of the legal legend. That is the way, and the only way, that the inflated mass of hokum known as the law might ever be exploded from the inside. But it is a possibility so remote that it is ridiculous to contemplate. For the vast majority of legal apprentices in the vast majority of law schools still go blissfully on pulling principles out of judges' opinions, being taught in mental goose step the sacred language of concepts and precepts, to emerge as doughty and undoubting defenders of the legal tradition, and perhaps to become eventually Wall Street law partners or Supreme Court justices. Those comparatively few students of those comparatively few law schools who do learn to recognize the great gap between worldly problems and legal principles, and who do not later fall prey to the propaganda of the trade they are practicing and forget all they once knew, can become extremely useful citizens. They have been trained to look at every legal problem as what it really is, a practical problem in the adjustment of men's affairs. They have been taught how to throw aside the entangling trappings of legal language and seeking a fair and reasonable and workable solution. And then, having found such a solution, how to wrap it up again in respectable legal clothes and work for it in terms of principles of law. In short, they have learned how to treat the whole of the law as a technique, as a means to an end, as pleading and procedure. And more than that, they have learned something woefully rare among the modern medicine men. They have learned to concentrate on the end, which is the practical solution of a human problem, instead of on the means, which is the law. Nor is it merely a question of being able to phrase a desired result in legal language and to support it with accepted legal principles, that because of the nature of legal principles is a pushover. Every lawyer can do that. Every lawyer does that every time he handles a case, although he may not always be aware that he is using a tool rather than fighting for the right in the realm of ultimate truth. It is instead a question of going at the solution of human problems in an intelligent and practical and socially useful way, and then, and only then, reverting to the medium of the law. It is a question of applying to any set of facts a combination of common sense and technical information and justice, undiluted by ambiguous principles, and letting the law fall where it may. Yet one bothersome query remains about the rare law school products who have learned how to do this. Why should their minds and their courses and their subsequent work be constantly encumbered with a lot of fool principles? Why, after all, should they have to learn the law, too? And that concludes tonight's reading of chapters 8 and 9. Next week, we'll go to chapter 10, which is A Touch of Social Significance. And the quotation that begins that chapter is, "Laws grind the poor, and rich men rule the law." Stated by Oliver Goldsmith. Ah, yes, the law. We are learning what the law is. All right, I am going to unmute everybody, and I'm going to ask everybody to then go back and hit star 6 and mute yourselves. That way we don't have to do all the stuff. I trust everybody to take care of their own business. So here we go. Everybody, please hit star 6 on your phones. I have a question. Can anyone tell me what text Dave is reading from? I will divulge the name and the author when I am finished with it. Because I want people to listen to it rather than try and go and just get it. You will have the source of it provided to you so that you can get it in written form. It is available, and there are some spelling corrections that need to be made in this document, as somebody has obviously transcribed this from the past. We've got somebody that needs to, I'm hearing noise in the background. They are not muted. If you would please mute your phones. If I see noise coming and somebody hasn't muted, then I'm going to, I think that solved it there. Okay, thank you. This will be made available. I'm making spelling error corrections as I go through this. I'm trying to do this every week. But as you can see, the law isn't quite what many people have thought it was, and I hope everybody is starting to get a better understanding of exactly how the law affects our lives, because it does affect our lives from the moment we wake up in the morning until the time that we fall asleep at night. It affects us in more ways than most people can imagine. And I'm not just talking about if you're involved in a court case or something. And I want to have some discussion about this after we're done with all of this reading. I'm fascinated by this, and this has really provoked a lot of thought in me, especially what was talked about tonight, pleadings and procedure. Do we talk very often on these calls, and is there information on the website telling people that they need to understand court procedure, and they need to learn how to write their pleadings, they need to learn how to write the documents, in other words, to learn some of the lingo? Of course. We talk about that all the time because it's ultimately important, because if you go into the court and you can't play the game, you're going to lose. The analogy I've used so many times of, if you go down to the local field house and they're getting ready for a basketball game and you go dashing in with your helmet, shoulder pads, and your football and say, yeah, I want to play too, you're going to have a problem. They're not going to let you play because you want to deal with first downs and touchdowns, and they're dealing with free throws and fouls. Two completely different games, and they don't mix. And if you try and bring your game on their court, they're not going to allow you to do so. That's just a fact. And I hope everybody is starting to understand more and more and more why learning this stuff about the courts is so incredibly important to help you properly deal with defending your rights and dealing with cases that may be filed against you or cases that you file against other people, how you can win your arguments. If you start really thinking about this stuff, the law is only what that judge and that court says it is at any given moment. That's the law. And if you're before a tribunal, an appeal situation, multiple judges, the law is what they say it is when that decision is rendered in that case. Make no mistake, that is the law. It's the pontification and opinion of one or a very small group of people at one given place, at one given time, and no more. And I don't care whether you're in a small claims court or in the Supreme Court of the United States. It is exactly, precisely the same. It truly is amazing to see what has happened to the world around us and how we are manipulated and dealt with by an incredibly small number of people that we allow to use this mumbo jumbo, whether it be in Washington, D.C., or your local justice court, to manipulate and control our lives. And dealing with one small group of people and changing what that one small group of people does and exposing it can make a difference so large in this country and in this world, most people can't even begin to imagine. Just think if we had a judicial system that didn't have the BS in it. It just was common law. And if you harmed me, you should be held responsible. And it doesn't take a bunch of fancy words to make some kind of a determination on that and have one person, one attorney, make a mistake and you not be compensated when you should be, simply because of a mumbo-jumbo mistake, which is exactly what happens day in and day out. Because always remember, the lawyers get paid whether you win or lose when they represent you. They get paid. Never lose sight of that. Okay,